Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this program is World Watchers. This is program number 765, August the 4th, 1984. I want to begin the broadcast by apologizing. I'm way behind in my mail. I usually fill the envelopes with the bibliography sheets that you send for. I'm about 2 months behind. I'll catch up maybe within the next 3 weeks. I've been going back and forth to Los Angeles, where I've had a very sick mother for the past 5 months. She's been just literally dying, and that has taken a lot of time, driving 300 miles each way between Carmel and L.A. She passed away this week, and as things quiet down now and the uncertainty of the trips and so forth takes over, I will get back to getting that mail out as fast as I can. Several months ago, when she was just about going into a coma and she was very, very weak, she looked at me and said, "Are you going to wear stockings to my funeral?" And I answered her, "If you die in the winter, yes, and if it's in the summer, no." Hard daughter to have, you must agree. Poor thing had to put up with me. She was 92 years old, and I'm 64, so she had that many years of May around. And right to the very end, she was trying to put her stamp, her Victorian stamp, or mode on what I should be doing. I want to mention the meeting that took place at the Bohemian Grove this past 2 weeks. I didn't get a chance to talk about it while it was taking place, but that really isn't too important. It will continue every year. Guests at the camp every year, the main stars are Henry Kissinger, Alexander Haig, William Buckley, and I mentioned several years ago when Henry Kissinger came in, they play Hail to the Chief. Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig are the proteges of that mysterious and never seen Fritz Kramer. I understand Daniel Ludwig, the mysterious Mr. Ludwig, who isn't seen too often, was at Bohemian Grove this past session. Now, if you want information on what Bohemian Grove is, you can send for tape cassettes or books on the material. It's very important to keep up with what this organization is and how important it is in our lives. This year they handed out a notice along with information on Bohemian Grove. What is Big Mountain relocation issue? The United States government is forcibly removing thousands of Navajo people from their homeland. And this reference sheet about the Bohemian Grove goes into the coal and uranium industries and the relocation law. And the Peabody Coal Company that's just one company that gains from moving the Indians from that particular territory. Then the information goes on, what are the Bohemian Grove connections? There are many Bohemians who pay their club dues out of revenues realized from the sacred mountain at sacred ground at Big Mountain. In the view of the elders, the real reason for the relocation is to promote the coal and uranium. Peabody Coal is one of the largest offenders. Bechtel Corporation owns 15% of Peabody Coal. S.D. Bechtel Jr. and Sr. are longtime Grove members and members of most prestigious camp, the Mandalay. They have built a family dynasty from their connections with business partners and advisors, including John McCone, former director of the CIA, also a Knight of Malta, the late Herbert Hoover and Edgar Kaiser, and others. Former Bechtel employees Caspar Weinberger and George Schultz are doing their power to promote the ambitions of the club members. Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Henry Kissinger are members. Also, Bechtel's connections to the nuclear power industry. They built Diablo Canyon, Sant Onofre, and others. This is legendary. Boeing Corporation holds 15% share of Peabody Coal. And, of course, Alexander Haig is now on the board of Boeing. Among their five Bohemian board members, directors are Stanley Hiller of Crocker Bank, who supports apartheid in South Africa, David Packard of Hewlett Packard. He was on the 40 committee in the national security, and he was director of the Defense Department under Richard Nixon. And the 40 committee, along with Henry Kissinger, are five people who decide who is assassinated by the CIA and what coups will take place. D.E. Skinner sits on the board of PGE&E. He helped build Diablo Canyon and Humboldt Nukes, and he's part of the Peabody Coal. The Fluor Corporation owns 10% of Peabody Coal. It was founded by CIA Director John McCone, who has brought present CIA Director William Casey as a guest to Bohemian Grove. It his one-time business partner was Mr. Bechtel. Mr. Casey was also a business partner of these people. Along with the Mandalay campmate Edgar Kaiser, who built Liberty ships for World War II, and the Hoover Dam with the blessing of the Bohemian Grove buddy Herbert Hoover, who was a campmate of Richard Nixon. And then it goes on to say space does not allow examination of the uranium nuclear corporations plundering the Indian American Indians lands, Kerr-McGee, Mobil, Conoco, United, Nuclear, Exxon, and others have Bohemian Grove connections, and they have direct interest into the uranium and the coal that is under the land where the Navajos are being replaced. Now, you can write to this organization, Bohemian Grove Action Network, P.O. Box 216, Occidental, California, 95465. If that goes too fast, just write to me, self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'll send you the sheet with his address. You can get an audio cassette on the power of Bohemian Grove, video cassettes. For $1 each, you can get leaflets such as Henry Kissinger and the Mandalay Camp, the Livermore Lab connections to the Bohemian Grove, the Manhattan Project's connections to the Grove, women in the Grove, women are excluded there, of course, and there's a $2 article about Henry Kissinger and his relationship to the people at Bohemian Grove and other selected news articles. There is a network informing you about the Grove. Now, there's another organization that isn't as well known as Bohemian Grove, and this is a very interesting phenomenon that takes place in Wyoming. And this is a group of people from the aviation industry, entirely aviation industry, and they call themselves the Conquistadores. I thought of the tall ships that were in the harbor celebrating the Statue of Liberty, and know that the Conquistador ships were for plundering South America, Central America, even America, and all over the world for Spain, and they were conquering ships that helped decimate native population. Now, there's an encampment in Wyoming that was described in Wall Street Journal this was last year, September 17th last year. Folks tell of strange doings every Labor Day. It's near Charlie's Gate at A Dude Ranch. The Night Riders have the armor of Spanish explorers. They descend from the hills in an eerie torchlight procession, aimed at summoning spirits of the conquistadores from centuries past. In the daytime, grown men wear dresses, and they chase each other in horseback. Other times, they do knife-throwing and fast-drawing. These fellows are chiefs of nearly every big airline and aerospace company in the United States: Boeing, General Dynamics, Lockheed, McDonnell Douglas, Rockwell International. The talk is about Conquistadores del Cielo, Spanish for conquerors of the sky. This is an exclusive and extremely secretive group. About 11 executives run it. The ranch is owned by Mr. Gates, chairman of Gates Learjet. The Conquistadores present in 1985 was Delta Airlines chairman David Garrett. The group was started by TWA executives in 1937. That's just at the height, I think, the parallels of this country and what Hitler is doing in Germany with some of his high people dressed in dresses in the same type of manner over there at the same time. It was started in 1937 as a social club with former aviators that were into the aviation business. The one thing they have is a passion for secrecy. Bohemian Grove in California is best known of the business-oriented clubs. The Conquistadores' passion for secrecy, plus the remote site in Wyoming, escaped scrutiny so far. The group concentrates the top two or three executives of companies and industries that have provoked concerns about industry collusion in the past. Ralph Nader said that the Conquistadori meetings hardly encourage free enterprise regarding airfares, defense contracts, getting information about air service because it's such a tight-knit family. Paul Thayer, a member of the Conquistadores, a member after 25 years, proved an embarrassment as Deputy Defense Secretary in the Reagan administration when he divulged insider information about corporate dealings. He's now serving 4 years in prison. And that is one of the dangers of these people getting together. For the one that gets caught, there are probably thousands that never do. Thayer used a Conquistador meeting to discuss the takeover battle between Bendix Corporation and LTV. Thayer was chairman of LTV, and he was director of Allied Corporation in 1982. Allied won the takeover. His company won the takeover. United Technologies Chairman Harry Gray and Martin Marietta Corporation Chairman Thomas Downall, both Bendix suitors, attended the conquistador meetings, and they were scheduled to testify if Thayer actually went to trial. Charles Reuchitzer, assistant U.S. attorney, prosecuted Thayer. He said he couldn't find evidence that the group was part of the scheme of leaking information, but the conquistadors was a place where they met, and later Thayer was linked to contacts in the conquistador meetings. The conquistadors have a way that is helpful for them and harmless to competition. Wayne Hoffman, chairman of Tiger International, was president in 1979. It was a conquistador meeting several years ago that Frank Lorenz, president of Texas Air Corporation, linked Continental's then-chairman Robert Seeks by suggesting a Texas Air-Continental merger. Texas Air won control of Continental in 1981. Frank Borman of Eastern Airlines quit several years ago. He wasn't happy with the frivolous nature of most conquistador activities. No women are invited, like Bohemian Grove, to be invited there. You have to get an invitation. And I believe it's open to the wives for just one evening. They are prohibited from attending the meetings are people in the government per se. These are the airline bosses and not the government. That makes it different than Bohemian Grove. But the contestants race horses around a corral. They wear dresses and racing back and forth in their dresses. Mr. Puckett and Sanford McDonald, chairman of McDonald Corporation, are pictured with pink frocks flapping behind them in the wind. Members wear 16th century costumes. They purchased them 34 years ago from the Royal Spanish Opera. Some wear ruffs. Other had military metal breastplates made and helms. The men wear the breastplates and the women dress as the grand dames of the Spanish era. Some paint on beards and they glue on whiskers and they have a great time, a huge viva, which is an illumination with a torch bearing it with the riders. Now, this doesn't compare, as I say, with the Bohemian Grove, but it is an example of the men dressing up like ladies, which they do at the Bohemian Grove, and they dress in their ballet tutus and other women's clothing at both places, and these men seem to have a desire to dress like women for their very private vacations. This type of vacationing may not seem important considering all the news that is pouring out these days, just gushing out. But think of the mindset of the people who run our CIA, the Knights of Malta, like Vernon Walters and William Casey and William Buckley, and I could go on, and people from the Defense Department who are knighted into the Roman Catholic Church. The Knights of Malta began in the year 1000. And so in 1986, these men are wearing breastplates and spears and dresses of the 16th century, which isn't really far off from when the Knights were formed, and there's a lot of decision-making in the White House, particularly with Ronald Reagan, with the staunch Knights of Malta, William Wilson, and I could go, you know, through the list of hundreds of names having high government positions, and it's interesting that some of them get together and have the need to go back to the 16th century with, the breastplates and even to dress as ladies. There's an article this past week about some Americans that were arrested in the Soviet Union as CIA agents, and the Soviet Union said Monday that the agents rehearsed their lines and put on makeup and wigs and women's clothing like Dustin Hoffman did in Tootsie. The government newspaper Izvestia ridiculed the agents, calling them diplomats who work for the CIA who are frustrated actors, and they referred to the way they get dressed up. And it's well known to the Soviet audiences, the movie such as Tootsie, but something very similar was taking place in the United States Embassy. A thick-set man with prominent belly and red mustache was being transformed into a woman, nice in every respect, with the help of a nylon bust, rouged mask, flower print blouse. The newspaper said the disguise was used on a spy mission, and one of those spies that was arrested last week was dressed as a lady. They referred to Tootsie, in which Dustin Hoffman played an unemployed actor who dresses as a woman to get a role in the soap opera, and it was a big hit in the Soviet Union in 1983. Izvestia said the government newspaper said the U.S. official who dressed in women's clothing was Lewis Thomas, a U.S. embassy security officer who was expelled in June of 83 on espionage charges. It was Michael Sellers, a U.S. political attaché, ordered to leave the country this year, who rehearsed dialogue and prepared his wardrobe before meeting a Soviet citizen in a clandestine encounter. Sellers usually wore a false mustache, glasses, and wig that were transformed into a Russian-style rabbit fur cap. Sellers, not without reason, had the reputation of a talented actor in the Central Intelligence Agency. Another diplomat transformed himself from an elegant young man to a weak-sided old man in spectacles for intelligence missions. Virtually everyone in the CIA reports to such tricks, from a small spy stuck among the participants of the anti-war movement to the director of the CIA himself. And remember the disguises E. Howard Hunt shared with us a little bit about them at the time of Watergate, and he was one of the highest officials of the Central Intelligence Agency. So a spy, or several of them, have been recognized in disguise, and they're now being discussed as having dressed as women. I imagine a lot of the encouragement is similar to, is not just disguise, but they probably like it, similar to the Bohemian Grove and to the Conquistadores. Mary Bancroft wrote a book about her experiences in the CIA, Autobiography of a Spy, published by William Morrow in 1983 out of New York. She was an interesting woman from a New England family, very prominent, who went into the OSS and served with the CIA after that with Alan Dulles, was his mistress, and was over in Europe helping him spy and living with a Nazi so that she could pick up information about Adolf Hitler while she was the liaison between the Nazi regime, one of them, a Mr. Gisevius, and then she would report back to Alan Dulles, who became her lover. Interesting, in this book, in her autobiography, she's talking about Carl Jung, and she went to work with him in Switzerland, also got fascinated with Jung. She said, one day Jung asked me if I ever heard the rumors that Gisevius, this friend of hers, flew regularly to advise Adolf Hitler. Of course I had. And she said, this was common knowledge to me, and it amused me greatly, and he chuckled. Then Jung thought the stories about his flying to Hitler had been started when Dr. Ferdinand Sauerbach, the famous Berlin surgeon who was supposed to be treating Hitler, began coming to Switzerland. And he asked me if Americans had heard that Hitler had begun to drink heavily. Then it goes on, I told Jung, I never succeeded in persuading anyone. He asked her if about Mein Kampf and the reaction of people to that. And I told Carl Jung, I'd never succeeded in persuading anyone to read Mein Kampf. I couldn't get them to buy it, even to read it, but they toss it aside, announce it as the man that was crazy and refused to continue. And she's telling this to the well-known psychoanalyst. They wouldn't even listen to his speeches for the same reason. It was no use pointing out to them that the insane asylums were full of people, none of whom had ever caused the havoc Hitler had. I found Mein Kampf fascinating, not only because it contained Hitler's plan of action that he seemed to be carrying out to the letter, but it also showed such a shrewd understanding of how to manipulate the psychology of the German people. Jung said the Germans were as clever about their own psychology as they were stupid about other people's. Certainly one of the best ways to learn about them was to study them at work on themselves. And he also said Goering could never exercise the magic that Hitler did. And they were talking about the various people that they knew and the hold that they had psychologically on the masses. Alan Dulles was interested in Jung's opinion of the effectiveness of Allied propaganda. Jung never ceased to point out the futility of negative propaganda, and he emphasized that the Germans spoke positively and gave them positive things on their own radio stations rather than the negative, and that he knew how to use the mind. Hitler used psychology. Instead of being a patient of psychology, he used it, and the real patients are the people who wouldn't read what he wrote. He was telling them something and was analyzed as crazy. And the truth was that Hitler turned out not to be so crazy. At least he was financed by the corporations and bankers all over the world who were sorry, actually, that he lost the war. And he had that charisma. But a lot of people missed the point about who Hitler was or what kind of thing he was, trying to say he was insane, where he really almost had control of the whole world. Very early in the war, there were some people, one man in particular, who risked his life to go to the Americans and to the OSS in Great Britain and tell them about the extermination camps. And again, the people didn't believe him. Justice Goldberg and future Chief Justice Frankfurter, they just couldn't believe what he was saying, and they didn't have any comprehension that things like this went on and the information was rejected. And there's a new book out called Breaking the Silence by Walter LeCour and Richard Breitman, published by Simon & Schuster. And this is about the individual, a Gentile, who, in August 1942, who went to London from Switzerland and tried to inform people about what was going on because he wasn't satisfied with Adolf Hitler. But his efforts didn't work because nobody wanted to believe him. And after the information came out that he was the messenger carrying this these facts, why he disappeared, nobody knew who he was, and this is the first research to dig him out and get the story about the gentleman with the courage to leave his offices in Switzerland, where he was doing quite well, and his name was Edward Schulte, S-C-H-U-L-T-E. The interesting thing is, in the book review in the New York Times, it says, Schulte's efforts to alert the outside world to the Nazis' intention to murder the Jews of Europe proved in vain. Not until millions had perished did the Allies accept the truth of the information he was the first to deliver. Even then, after he delivered, there was no measure to halt the slaughter. Schulte never went on delivering data to Allied intelligence because, at the end of 1943, he was almost unmasked, and in return he would have been killed, when a Swiss typist in his employ found a carbon copy used to copy a report he had written for the American agent Alan Dulles and turned it over to her lover, an SS man. So this poor gentleman, Edward Schulte, was reporting to Alan Dulles about the extermination camps, and Alan Dulles was living in Bern, Switzerland, working also with people like SS Karl Wolf, who was simultaneously running Treblinka and the gas extermination camps. And Alan Dulles was literally in bed with the Nazis from the time he moved to Bern, Switzerland. He became our future director of the Central Intelligence Agency. But the very fellow who had confidence that somebody would do something for him, it didn't happen that way. And Alan Dulles was the man who was receiving his information. And you wonder why more wasn't done, because Dulles could quiet it on all cables coming to the United States at that point and make sure that nobody responded to the information coming. Now, I mentioned last week the new executive order that Ronald Reagan passed, and I didn't have the exact number. I thought I had it, and actually it was right. And the order was, in 1981, President Reagan issued Executive Order 12333, which empowers the Central Intelligence Agency to operate domestically under certain circumstances. And, of course, he determines the circumstances. That is Order 12333. So he has the power now. As I mentioned last week, the military can go into 50 states for the first time. The military can legally go take over for anything if they think it's terrorism, drugs, and so forth. And domestically, the CIA has been allowed to do this since 1981. I feel sorry that I can't update the stories because of lack of time, again, on Jonathan J. Pollard. And I want you, listeners, to save the articles and help me just give a little time and space, and I'll go on to that spying operation that is so important. And the Israeli operations have a lot to do with James Angleton working with Rafi Itan. I mentioned that before. For 20 years, until 1974, the Mossad and the Israeli government were really bonded to American intelligence, to James Angleton, who was a part of the Permandex operation and the assassination team that killed John Kennedy. And James Angleton had set up really a murder incorporated that included Rafi Itan of the Mossad, included drug dealing and murder. And I'll get more details and outline. I have approximately 70 or 80 good articles, and we can't do all of them, but I'll share a few with you and outline those for you on the special relationship of Israel to the intelligence community. Now, this whole story keeps bubbling over more and more because the right-wing newspapers, such as the New Solidarity and Liberty Lobby keep pressuring the story of why isn't the Defense Department prosecuting the Israeli spies or going into it more? How deep does it go? And it involves uranium that's missing and a lot of other things. And the answer is that Israel is the buffer to send weapons to the Contras, to the Argentine military dictatorship when it was in, to South Africa, and they're also involved in Pakistan and all over the world where there's drugs and assassinations, and the Defense Department gets nudged by the far right to go into these connections, and the CIA, headed also by George Shultz and William Casey, trying to stop the investigations because the use of Israel, of the Mossad, with our own 40 committee to do the dirty work that we needed done in exchange for the drug traffic that became so lucrative. There was a report, I guess all of you heard it on the evening news this past week, U.S. may end shuttles commercial launches. Now, the first announcement on the news was that the shuttle space program, NASA, will be diverted to the military. NASA will become military and literally part of the Defense Department. That's exactly what I said was the motive of letting the Challenger blow up as an excuse, because we're limited to turn over the whole Defense Department, the NASA that was supposed to be civilian, to the Defense Department. They also are trying to ease out the Houston Space Center, the Johnson Space Center in Houston, and move it to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, where the Wernher von Braun, Walter Dornberger clique, the Project Paperclip, the Nazi scientists that wanted to use space to control the world, controlled the decision that the shuttle would launch no matter what kind of weather, and they're getting more power right now as of this directive. They announced that the Department of Defense has 28 loads to go, and they literally will try to merge space with defense. Now, even a few very conservative congressmen and senators, Orrin Hatch for one, was outraged to hear this. And the trickery of combining these two, I detailed in my many broadcasts on the Challenger and showed how in 1983, when Edward Teller gave the speech with Ronald Reagan or wrote it for him on Star Wars of March 83, and then the use of the Korean Airline line, the spying ship that was blown up for the military budget for the Star Wars, and then the Challenger going down with these tragedies and accidents, which are experimental also in nature, they get so much more out of it, and by the Challenger going down, it separated what is civilian space from war, and the space area will be turned over to the military, and they'll use rockets that are not manned by people, and automatic rockets, or put payloads over in Europe or elsewhere, and now say because of the Challenger accident, the space has become military. That was the intention 40 years ago, but they created these crises that made it come about. They also published the conversation in the cockpit. I'm sure many of you saw it, but there was something very interesting in it. At 1:47 before it launched, Mr. Smith, the co-pilot, whose wife has sued NASA for $23 million for a knowledgeable death, a death that was caused through information that could have been avoided, Smith says, okay, there goes the lock's arm. And they referred to the vent arm that covers the tip of the shuttle's external tank during fuel loading that carries oxygen vapor and prevents ice buildups. The part that prevents ice buildups, which was important, and I don't know too much about spaceships, but the device is known as a beanie cap. And 1 minute later, Scobie said, goes the beanie cap, that's the cap, the external cap, the tip that covers this area. And Onizuka, the one of the men, NASA men, on this space Challenger said, doesn't it go the other way? And they laughed. And then Mr. Smith, Commander Smith, said, God, I hope not. And Onizuka said, I can't see it moving. It was behind the center screen. Now, I talked to somebody familiar with the space shuttle program and has seen launches. He told me they were only joking. But I don't think just a minute before launch that a pilot would say, God, I hope not. Because if he's being told something, he could stop it right there, I should think, and scratch the launch at that point, 1 moment before going. But is he taking a risk? You're right. You know, if you're right, we're okay. We're in trouble. If you're wrong, it'll be disastrous. What did he mean by, I hope not, that doesn't sound like the usual language of people just about to launch, particularly on the cold weather, knowing the problems of the cold weather. The article in the New York Times, July 26, says, head of NASA attempts to calm Houston's fear on the role in space, and Mr. Fletcher is apologizing for the fact that the power will be moved to Alabama and the defense civilian part of it will be eased out pretty much. They'll ease it out and give the attention to the military as the Johnson Space Center becomes maybe a relic, a dinosaur of the space past. Who knows? I'll take a 1 minute break now because the tape is about up, and then I want to update a few items of the news very quickly with you.